From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
From 2008 to this summer, today's guest, Jane Perrone, was gardening editor for The Guardian newspaper in the UK, where she lives with her husband, who is forced to compete for Jane's attentions with a lot of insistent, needy houseplants. Which is our subject today? Not the husband, but the houseplants, that is, and we'll talk specifically about Jane's newish podcast called On the Ledge, with its sometime motto, Saving Your Houseplants from Certain Death Since February 2017. I'm having fun listening in to each episode, and I'm glad Jane made time to speak today. So welcome to Away to Garden, just as we officially kick off houseplant season. Jane Perrone, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. Oh. And you're absolutely right that my houseplants are competing for my attention with the dog, the husband, the children. So, yes, I just actually rearranged my kitchen windowsill full of houseplants today, and it was so satisfying. But I've now got a load of refugees that I turfed off there that I'm not quite sure where to put. So,
oops.
Yeah.
So, before we get started, we should tell everyone that this segment is actually sort of one half of a podcasting duet, because we are visiting each other's shows this week, right, to talk about houseplants. I visited you, and we'll give the links to each other's and so forth with the transcripts and all that kind of good stuff. But a quick question also unrelated to houseplants first before we really dig in. Did you go to Louisiana State University? Did I read that somewhere?
Yes, I did. I know. How unexpected is that? Yes, I did. I did my master's in mass communication there because my undergraduate university in the UK had some kind of deal where they sent people over who wanted to go after doing their undergraduate degree. And I ended up there for 2 years, which was amazing, amazing place. And very eye-opening for a young lady from England to be going to such a place. And it was fantastic. And now I look back and wish, I mean, I guess your 20s is perhaps the one, well, it was back then anyway, the one time when you weren't really into plants. And I remember looking and seeing caladiums used as bedding plants.
Yes.
And remembering back to my childhood at what a tricky houseplant they were if you tried to grow them in your house in the UK, and thinking, wow, they're growing them as houseplants here. That's crazy. Mm-hmm. So even then I was still thinking about plants. But yeah, so that was an eye-opener.
Right.
And I still long for a beignet now and again.
Don't we all? Because a lot of our houseplants, what made me laugh when I noted it, I don't even know where I saw it, but a lot of our houseplants could probably, as you say, stay outside all winter there and save us a lot of hassles.
So true. I'm so jealous of people who live in subtropical climates.
Yeah. But where you live now, tell us the basic, where you are, kind of what the basic seasons, like frost-free season and gardening, quote-unquote, season and so forth, just so we have perspective.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in the UK, where I am, which is a few miles north of London, the situation is you're really looking at a frost-free situation from mid to late May. Will be the last frost. So that'll be when I'd be putting tomato plants outside. And then now, where are we now? So we're start of October, no frost yet here. And I think probably on a good year, we might get away with that till into November, but it just depends. It doesn't get, well, it certainly hasn't done tremendously cold here. We get some snow, some sub-zero temperatures, but it's not kind of deep, deep snow. And minus 10, minus 20 habitually. It's a bit milder than that generally. But it really varies. We've had some really cold years and some very mild years. So you never know.
Yeah. I can't resist, because we're two longtime garden writers on opposite sides of the ocean. You know, I can't resist asking you sort of, what kinds of stories are what's the trends there? I mean, like the things that are trendy right now, and there is a reason that I'm asking. But, you know, here it's like 9 million shades of Calibrachoa, dumpy mound-shaped dwarf hydrangea paniculatas, garden centers where you can buy handbags as well as everything else under the sun, not just plants. I mean, those are some of the trends. Obviously, native plants and pollinator-friendly plants, those are big trends of a more serious nature. But, like, what's going on there, just to, again, set the scene of, like, you know, horticulture there?
Well, we, as in all things, we get a lot of our trends imported from the US. So a lot of the things are very, very similar. I mean, we would like to think that we lead the way in horticulture here, but oftentimes we're following your trends. I think that, you know, there's always a place for the horrible bedding plant. The horrible bedding plant, and the, you know, over here, meerkat sculptures were really big for a while. You could put them in your garden, and it was like a meerkat standing up. You know, horrendous things like that.
Inexplicably
popular.
I missed that.
Yeah, it's bad. But I would say similarly, native plants and plants for pollinators are really getting ever more popular.
Okay.
And also, you know, the whole sort of, I mean, I must say, of course, that houseplants are incredibly popular, and that particularly cacti and succulents are incredibly popular. And, you know, almost everybody has a couple of little succulents on their windowsill, sometimes looking sad, sometimes not, but they're becoming ubiquitous.
Yeah, because that's what I wondered. Was it like a trend of some kind, you know, what led you to start an indoor plant podcast? You know, was it a personal passion or, you know, something you thought that was, you know, a kind of a happening thing as well?
Well, I have been growing houseplants. In fact, if you look on my Facebook page, there's a horrendous picture of me. I can't remember how old I was, a teenager probably, in double denim in my bedroom with a table full of houseplants. So I've been into houseplants for as long as I can remember.
Okay.
And it's really nice that suddenly everybody is not looking at you like you're a mad woman, but actually going, oh yeah, houseplants, and willing to have a conversation about them. So after, you know, however many years of growing them, suddenly it's cool, which is a really nice, refreshing thing.
Yeah.
So I've always been into them.
Yeah.
Always love them. Or, you know, from a child growing things like the mother of thousands. I used to love growing that plant, the one with the little tiny baby plants all along the edge, Calanco, Digromontiana. And cacti and saving plants from the bin in Woolies and all kinds of things I used to grow. And I had a big, massive fish tank in my bedroom, which contained plants. But because I really didn't know what I was doing and probably couldn't afford to buy compost, I used garden soil. So it was also a bit of a wormery in there. There were lots of earthworms roaming around. So I've always been into houseplants. And when I did a podcast on gardening for The Guardian called So Grow Repeat, which I did with Alice Fowler, and I just loved doing it. I really enjoyed podcasting. And when that ended, I just thought, this can't be the end. I have to do more podcasting. And I immediately thought of doing it about houseplants because, well, A, it's a passion of mine, and B, nobody else was doing it. So that was why I struck out and decided that was my topic.
So, I mean, I want to talk about how serious your own personal houseplant issue is, because when we spoke on taping your show, I confessed that I have a lot of them and there's not a lot of room in my house in the winter for me in certain rooms near the brightest windows. And you know, and I have some sort of obsessions like fancy leaf begonias. I have a lot of big fancy leafed old begonias and clivias, which I think you pointed out are sort of a granny kind of plant, and indeed mine probably came from my grandmother. You know, I've got a lot of big ones. And then I love those things with caudexes, the sort of things that have swollen above the soil surface bases, you know, and I talked to you about my bombax and my boea and all kinds of oddities. So how serious and what's the nature of your problem over there?
Well, it's getting more serious by the day. I mean, when my kids are sort of 10 and 7 now. So when my kids were younger, I definitely dropped the houseplant ball quite a lot because I had my hands full, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
So I've been building up my collection since they kind of got to the age where they were sort of heading off to school and not quite so dependent. And it's been getting ever more serious since then. And I just keep buying more. In fact, a box arrived yesterday with another 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 houseplants in them. So I used to have a lot of carnivorous plants, which I gave away when I had babies and didn't really feel like I could cope with. I've just bought a sundew and a pinguicula So I'm getting back into that. And yeah, so it's pretty serious. You know, I find myself looking around houseplant sale sites quite frequently. And you know, people are very lovely. People, if I say, oh, I really want this, people have quite frequently sent me something. So when I did an episode recently on the very desirable Pilea peperomioides, the Chinese money plant, and was commenting on how difficult these were to get hold of and the fact that I didn't have one, a lovely listener sent me one. So I'm being enabled by my listeners.
Okay, so it's not really your fault. You're powerless. It's not my fault. You're powerless over houseplants. Okay. So I love that segment about the Chinese money plant, Pilea peperomioides. And sort of speaking again of trends, like who knew there were it houseplants? But this turns out to be one. So you told me, I saw it on your, heard on your podcast, saw it on, you know, your website. I saw the picture. I kind of started searching around because you said it was expensive and really hard to get. And I looked around in the U.S., you know, and it turns out like that there's a whole world about this plant online. And I guess partly that's because of maybe Instagram and YouTube and so forth, don't you think?
Yes, most definitely. And you look at the plant and you kind of think, whoa, what is it about this plant that's so makes it so desirable? And I think it's just partly that it's that it has been quite rare and quite hard to get hold of. It is quite a sweet plant. It's got coin-shaped leaves and it's a lovely color and it can be a nice shape, but it's there are many other wonderful plants that don't fall into this category of desirability, so you do wonder why. But it just has got to a silly stage, and I think it will pass. You know, people are paying $50 American for this thing at the moment in some cases, but I think it will come down in price. And the thing about this plant is it's incredibly easy to propagate.
Yes,
it just produces lots. It's a bit like a spider plant in that sense.
Yes,
so imagine if we were all going nuts over spider plants. But it will get more easily easy to source, and a lot of plant companies are now starting to sell it and realizing that it's something that people want. But again, it's just like any fashion, there's no particular rhyme or reason to it other than people want it because they can't get hold of it.
Right. It's interesting because the genus Pilea is, we have a native wildflower, I guess you'd call it a native plant here, that is Pilea pumila. Mm. And it's an important host plant for certain, I think, moths or whatever. I don't even remember, but it's an important native plant in sort of semi-shady places in the Northeast. I don't know how far in the country it goes. So when I saw that genus, I was like, what? A house plant? What? you know, because some genera are just full of a real diversity of things, you know, with a wide range of hardiness and so forth. And I was interested in maybe the fact that you did your podcast about it, and that it is, as I said, it's sort of this it plant, and there's things on YouTube and here and there and about it. I saw that in the U.S., one of our longest time mail order suppliers of really exceptional houseplants, Logies Nursery, which is in Connecticut, he just did, the owner, Byron, he just did a YouTube segment about it. And apparently they've been growing it forever and ever and ever. And so suddenly there's like requests for it. So I think you've contributed to the trend, Jane.
Yeah. Funnily enough, I did actually, I didn't quite happen, but I did ask Byron for an interview about the plant because I knew that they've been growing it for years. And unfortunately he was traveling. It didn't work out, but I think it's definitely something that people are catching on to. But at the same time, also some people are sort of say, well, what are you talking about? I've been growing this plant for years and my grandmother gave it to me. So it's old and new. I mean, I won't tell the whole story here, but there's a fantastic story about how it was discovered in the UK, which involves, it was known by houseplant enthusiasts before it was known by the botanists at Kew Gardens, basically.
Oh.
And so they kept getting samples of this plant brought to them, and they were wondering, what is it? We can't identify exactly what kind of Pilea it is. And the route back to find the origins of this plant involved a celebrity hairdresser in London who had got it off somebody else, who'd got it off an au pair from Norway, and it that so the torturous route went on. So it's got a nice backstory. And
yeah.
I think that so sells it to people.
Well, speaking of things that are catching on or that we ought to catch, one of your recent episodes of On the Ledge was about fungus gnats. And call them, I mean, some of the stuff you say and write is just slays me. I love it. You call them the pipsqueaks of the pest world and the spaced out hippies of the pest world because of the way they sort of zoom all over the place. And I think on Twitter or somewhere I saw you say that you out the fun in fungus gnats. Anyway, why this topic? Was your husband like furious about uninvited guests in the house or what?
Well, no, he's incredibly unobservant, so he probably would spot them anyway. Of plant things, he just isn't interested. So that's great because he just gets on with it. I was getting annoyed by them, and I've had lots of readers over the time I've been doing the podcast asking for answers about this particular pest, which is funny, really, because it's not really that damaging. It's just really annoying.
Yes.
But people want an answer. And, you know, it was great to be able to speak to a couple of experts who could actually give some really good solutions, which do work. And so that's what we try to bring is, you know, the actual scientific solutions, because the problem is that lots of things on the internet,
I know
there's so much kind of
home remedies,
you know. I didn't quite get to the point of reading out, you know, put vinegar on it, but somebody's going to suggest apple cider vinegar somewhere along the way.
Right.
Somebody's going to suggest dish soap. Somebody's going to suggest, pouring fabric softener on your soil, as somebody did. There's some really strange ideas about houseplants, and so it's good to actually have some science backing to say, no, this is what actually works.
And what I see, to me, I have to confess, I really almost never have fungus gnats, even though I have a ton of houseplants, but I'm an underwaterer. That is my thing, is that I underwater my plants because I feel like they perform better when I don't swamp them. So plus I mostly use a mix that is a little bit more bark-based, like a shredded, you know, aged. It's not as heavy in the peat, so it doesn't stay sodden too long.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so I'm just thinking, I mean, again, who knows the reason, but that's what I'm thinking. But what were a couple of the reasons that were not the homespun remedies?
So, overwatering is a massive contributing factor to a big fungus gnat infestation. So if you overwater, you're more likely to have more of a problem because the flies lay their eggs in damp soil. So if there's not a lot of damp soil, then a few eggs will be laid, but not as many as will be in damp soil. The other thing to bear in mind with fungus gnats is that the best way of getting rid of them actually is microscopic nematode worms, which you can apply as a drench to the soil. And the great thing about this particular solution is that it's totally safe. You know, you're not going to be hurting your pets or yourself or anything in your house other than the fungus gnat larvae by applying this stuff, which is great. So you can apply this stuff and it's a pretty gross tale. But what happens is the nematode worms get inside the larvae and kind of eat them out from within using enzymes. On a very small scale, thank God we can't see it. So, and it really does work. And I have tried that solution myself. It's not the cheapest option, but it will get it under control. And the other thing to bear in mind is there are two kind of major seasons of fungus gnats in the spring and about now. So even if you are having a big problem, it will ease off as the weeks go by.
Yeah, some of those biological controls are the things of horror movie plots, aren't they?
Totally. But I'm glad that they're doing a good job. The only other thing to say about those biological controls, it applies to all of them, is that you just need to be really careful to follow the directions closely and use them before they'll have a best before date on the packet. And you must use them because otherwise they don't necessarily won't be viable if you leave it too long.
Right.
So that's, but if you do that, you should get on top of the problem.
I smiled to see that you did a segment of your podcast of On Ledge on starting avocados from what I would call, being American, a pit, and you would call
a pit a stone.
It's a pit, girl. It's not a stone.
I've never heard. That's a real difference because nobody in this country would call it a pit.
Well, I just don't think they would. And I'm wearing a sweater, and you're wearing a You know, we
a
could
jumper.
Go, exactly.
Yeah,
we could go exactly. on and on and on. But that cracked me up because I didn't know the what I call the pit, or in the United States we call the pit, of an avocado, which we grow avocado pits as, you know, a classroom thing when we're kids in grade school. I didn't know you called it a stone. That was one I didn't know, so it made me smile.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah,
and it's a kind of a fun thing to do. I mean, the resulting plant is not the most amazing looking thing. It's no less or more attractive than a Pilea peperomioides, but it's just a fun thing to do, and people seem to have got a kick out of it. So that was a fun one.
Well, I think it has a sentimental, like I said, we have a memory of probably having tried it, you know, at one point in our lives. So in our last few minutes, I want to ask you, what in the world is a marimo moss ball?
Oh, my gosh.
And not
yes.
moth ball, but moss, M-O-S-S ball.
Well, the confusing thing about the marimo moss ball is it's not moss. So this
okay.
came up in an early episode when I spoke to a guy called Christopher Satch from The Sill, which is a New York-based company that supplies houseplants and does kind of everything houseplant. And we were talking about office plants, and I was asking for ideas for low-maintenance office plants. And he said, well, of course, the lowest-maintenance office plant is the marimo moss ball, because you just literally stick it in some water and do nothing. And I raised my eyebrows and then went away and Googled and discovered that it really is a low maintenance houseplant, if you can call it a houseplant. It's actually a ball of filamentous algae. So
yeah.
These marimo moss balls, I guess they've been given that name to make them sound a bit cuter. Their habitat is the bottom of lakes in various places in Japan and other parts of the world. They just kind of roll around at the bottom of freshwater lakes, and they're green and fuzzy and about the size, well, anything from sort of the size of a walnut up to a billiard ball or a little bit bigger, and they just kind of sit in water, and that's about all you're going to get from them. But you don't have to do anything. I've got one in my kitchen. I've got a tall kind of apothecary's jar
yeah.
with some big fairly attractive stones in it, and three marimo moss balls, and they just sit there. And every now and again, by which I mean maybe every 3 or 4 months, I change the water. And then is actually the most interesting bit, in that when you squeeze water out of them and then put them back in the water, they do this thing where they go up and down for about a week as they get the pressure sort of equals out.
Oh,
and they get
goodness.
Filled with water.
Bouncing
balls. So they start
balls.
Going up and down.
Bouncing
like
balls. They're bouncing marimo moss
yeah.
balls. Yeah. That's
I mean,
funny.
If you are the person who kills every single houseplant you've ever grown, this is the thing to try. You can also have them in fish tanks, not with goldfish, because goldfish will destroy them, but you can have them in other kinds of fish tanks.
Uh-huh.
And they kind of, as I say, in Japan, they're a real kind of thing. And if you can go into, you can Google around this and go nuts, because you'll find out all kinds of strange things about marimo moss balls and the Japanese. They really love them and they're very proud of them. And they're getting increasingly popular to buy. I mean, I saw a garden center recently advertising them here. So you can imagine, if you're somebody who goes away a lot and you don't have much time for a houseplant, you could start
know,
here
but
with the marimo moss ball.
It's technically not even a plant. I mean, it has no roots. It has no stem. It doesn't reproduce like a plant. You know what I mean? It's technically not even algae.
I mean,
it's
I don't
algae.
Know why they didn't call it filamentous algae, because, I mean, that's going to appeal to all of us, isn't it?
Oh, my
yeah,
goodness.
It's good marketing on the part of somebody somewhere who's producing these plants, or not plants.
Well, Jane Perrone, I'm so glad that we reconnected after a number of years of speaking only infrequently, and that and also I'm just so glad that you're doing the houseplant subject, you know, your podcast On the Ledge as about houseplants, because it really is something that I've always loved too. To me, it was like the gateway to gardening, you know. It was like what got me going, and yet it stayed with me, and I just can't imagine life without my houseplants. So I salute you. I love it.
Thank you very much.
And
well,
hope,
that's great to
yeah,
hear.
I hope we'll talk again soon.
Thank you so much.
Okay. And I hope we'll all talk again soon, too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Stitcher or iTunes. You can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or facebook.com/awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime, indoors and out.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.